John Doe is one of the most interesting serial killers in the history of cinema. Let's break down what makes this character so fascinating from the film Seven in this episode of Evil Explorer.
What's up, movie friends? Welcome back to Raiders of the Lost Podcast, the ultimate film and TV podcast. And today we are doing a very special character analysis and breakdown of John Doe, the incredible antagonist and villain of the film Seven, which was a landmark crime thriller and drama from David Fincher. I can't believe that was his second freaking movie. That's insane.
Can you imagine making that for your second movie?
Unbelievable.
It's one of the best of all time, that and Pulp Fiction for Tarantino.
Oh, yeah, I agree. For sure, it's up there. And it actually got to him by accident. The screenplay from Andrew Kevin Walker was accidentally sent to David Fincher, and he read the screenplay, immediately was like, I need to make this movie. So he worked really hard to get it done, got Brad Pitt interested. They sat down and had a chat, and Brad Pitt was on board, and that was pretty much almost soothsailing until he had to fight with the studio to keep the ending. But it really was an accidental miracle in a way, and David Fincher is the perfect director for this movie, and he made one of the greatest films, in my opinion, of all time. Everything from the cinematography to the music from Howard Shore to the editing, every camera decision, every blocking decision that David Fincher makes in this movie, lens choices, it's all perfect and incredible. The acting is phenomenal from the lead cast. Obviously, from Kevin Spacey, who is sensational as John Doe, one of the most iconic villains and serial killers in cinematic history. And I can't wait to get into this deep dive, character analysis, and breakdown of John Doe, because he is John Doe by choice.
And Seven came out in 1995, directed by David Fincher, written by Andrew Kevin Walker, is an 8.6 on IMDb. It's an all-timer, ladies and gentlemen. It's number 19 on the IMDb user all-time rating list. Rotten Tomatoes, it's a kind of low 82%.
What critics the fuck?
Score. Critics, come on. Come on, critics. 95% audience score. And this movie is just a masterpiece. It's perfect in every single way. And just a warning, you know, we're talking about a movie with serial killing. There's some graphic nature in this episode, so just a heads up, we'll be referencing murders and killings as well as some gore probably. But we have to talk about it because this is such an incredible film. And the plot of it is, in an unnamed city, two detectives are investigating a series of murders committed by a serial killer who's using the seven deadly sins as inspiration for his murders, including gluttony, greed, sloth, pride, lust, envy, and wrath.
I like how, so you mentioned that we're going to be talking about serial killings in this episode. What's the great irony of Seven, and this is what makes it so cool, the great irony of Seven is we only see one murder take place. We only see one killing happen, and it's not even by the hand of John Doe. It's Mills killing John Doe. In Seven, the film, the only killing we see is by a person who isn't John Doe, the serial killer and villain of the movie.
That's absolutely incredible. I love that so much. it is ironic because when people think about Seven, if they're not cinephiles, they haven't seen it many times, or they've just heard of the movie, they think, oh, I don't want to watch something so gory and so violent. It's not really that violent. I mean, there are some violent scenes here and there. Obviously, like, someone gets killed and executed on screen. But aside from that, we see the aftermath of the murders, which is just as terrifying and horrific as if we saw it, but more powerful when it comes to cinema storytelling.
I'll tell you why it's more powerful.
Tell us why, Anthony.
It's our imagination.
Imagination.
So David Fincher understood when he made this film how strong the screenplay was from Andrew Kevin Walker, and he knew that the story was so immensely powerful that he didn't have to show things. You don't have to show Kevin Spacey until an hour or 20 minutes into the movie. You don't have to show a head in the box. Some people actually think they saw a head in the box, but they didn't.
Don't even cut to the box, because really, besides when it's getting cut open.
Exactly. That's how powerful it is, because it's our minds and our imaginations. They're doing all the work for us. And that's because you can compare Seven to Jaws in terms of horror films with the antagonist, with the monster. So with Jaws, you have the shark, and with Seven, you have John Doe, another monster. What's so famous about Jaws? You don't see the shark that often. For a monster movie, you barely see it until really the third act. Same thing happens with Seven. If Seven wouldn't be that strong of a film, it'd still be a great film, but it would not be nearly as good as it is if we were getting scenes of John Doe committing his acts, or if we had John Doe torturing his his victims, or, you know, if you had scenes of him like holding the gun to the glutton's head, or telling Eli Gould to cut off his flesh and sitting in that room waiting with them, or telling the woman, oh, if you take the pills, you'll die, but if you call for help, you'll be disfigured forever. We don't see him doing those scenes. We don't see him. We don't see his actions. We never see a single one of John Doe's physical actions, except for when he's escaping, evading the police, and then when he walks into the precinct. That's what makes the film so special, and that's what makes John, one of the reasons why John Doe is so memorable. It's because we don't see all that stuff. All that stuff is repetitive. We've seen it a million times. It takes away the power. Instead, what we're getting is the aftermaths. We're getting the reactions. We're getting the grisly, heinous crime scenes. We're getting the disturbing imagery. We're getting all of that instead of actually seeing the scenes take place. And in so many ways, it's more terrifying for the audience and more disturbing for the audience because our imagination is working those scenes out for us. We see the images of Eli Gould carved up on his rug with the greed and blood everywhere and the scale with flesh in it. We're imagining, as an audience, we're imagining what happened. We don't have to see what happened. We're imagining it in our minds. And that imagination and that power within us of visualizing scenarios is really the core of what makes Seven such a terrible, terribly disturbing and great horror film.
And there are so many religious motifs in this film. Obviously, so many sevens and references to seven, but Christianity, Catholicism, the references are integral to the story, integral to the character. And John Doe sees himself as a vessel of a higher power, a righteous figure in a path of determinism or fatalism of doing God's work, as he explains. And we have the seven sins, the seven deadly sins, which oppose the seven virtues. So the seven heavenly virtues are chastity, temperance, charity, diligence, patience, kindness, and humility. And they oppose the seven deadly sins of wrath, greed, sloth, pride, lust, envy, and gluttony. And if humanity or John Doe represents the seven deadly sins, you could argue that maybe, I was just thinking about this, maybe Somerset represents the seven virtues of mm-hmm. chastity. He doesn't have a partner, temperance, charity, diligence, patience, kindness, humility. He sort of has a lot of those traits if you think about it.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And it's just an interesting thought that just popped in my head. Do you think that they fit in terms of being opposites of each other? If John Doe is the seven deadly sins, if Somerset is the seven virtues?
Well, I would just say that John Doe is lacking most of the sins.
True. He just represents the sins.
Humanity
are the sins. Yeah. That's the whole point of his mission.
And Somerset is like a shining angel in a way, a guardian angel for good.
Yeah. And so, well, we have seven murders, obviously, in this movie
mm-hmm.
over the course of 7 days. They almost occur on every single day, except for there's a few days in between, but the story is told through Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Three of the murders occur on Sunday. It's a big day, busy day on the rest day.
Now, a lot on the books. John Doe had a busy day.
Busy Sunday. And obviously, Divine Comedy by Dante is referenced in the movie, so is in Paradise Lost. And the screenwriter obviously used these as inspiration for the film and for the writing of the murders as well. So, for example, in Purgatory, the gluttonous must experience excruciating hunger and thirst as their punishment. So, and then in the film, the glutton is killed face down in a bowl of spaghetti after eating his spaghetti so much until he bursts.
Mm-hmm.
All right. In Purgatory, the wrathful must walk through acrid, dark smoke, unable to see the outside world. Of course, wrath is Mills, who commits murder, and we can assume will probably go to prison and lose his job, and he's lost his wife and his unborn child with that as well.
Walking in a smoky room doesn't really sound that bad.
In Purgatory, the slothful souls must run constantly.
Oh, damn.
Sounds exhausting. Sounds in the awful. Film. Sloth murder is of the man inside the
Vincent.
Room. Vincent, who's been trapped inside that room for an entire year, and he was chosen because he was a pedophile.
A drug dealer and a pederast, but a drug dealer for sloth because you could say that the drugs he sold made people sloth.
And he's strapped into a bed for a year as he lay rotting away. And Dante, the greedy, were forced to lay face down on the hard ground, which in the film, the lawyer who was greedy, he is killed and is forced to slice part of his body off. He goes for the abdomen. to slice off, he needs a pound of flesh.
He goes for the love handle.
Goes for the love
handle. 1 pound of flesh, no more, no less.
No more, no less, and dies, obviously, from it.
Cut through his own stomach lining.
Oh, my God. It's pretty crazy. Then we have, in 7, the man full of envy kills a woman by cutting her head off, which is obviously John Doe. His sin is envy, and he takes Tracy's head.
Her pretty head.
He envied Mill's normal life, which he knew he could never have. He tried to play husband, but it just didn't work out. In purgatory, lustful are thrown violently into a potent wind, which is pretty intense.
Okay.
In the film, a man is forced to murder a prostitute for lust by having sex with her with a razor-bladed sex penetration
object.
Object. I don't know how best to describe that.
Sounds. Item, I mean, that sums it up pretty much.
And then we have, obviously, in 7, the murder of the woman with the pills by either taking sleeping pills to end her life right there, or if she calls for help, she will be disfigured for life.
John also, I think, has 7 strong traits within him. I made a list of 7 strongest traits. So
you admire this guy.
I just wanted to express my admiration for you police officers.
I admire you.
So
it's a reference to 7.
His most powerful traits are: he is unhinged, he is patient, he's ruthless, he's intelligent, apathetic, solitary, and brutal. And all these facets are shown on screen in many ways. However, I think the way to best define John is the term misanthrope. So John Doe is a misanthrope. Now, misanthropy is the general hatred, dislike, or distrust of the human species, human behavior, or human nature in general. A misanthrope is someone who holds such views or feelings. Misanthropy involves a negative evaluation of attitude towards humanity, and that is based on humankind's flaws. So you can relate that to John having this horribly negative view of humanity based on humankind's sins. Misanthropes hold that these flaws characterize all, or at least the greater majority of human beings. So this again ties to him. He's putting the sins of the few onto the backs of everybody. He's saying everybody is a sinner just because he sees sins when he looks out his front door on every corner, he says. They also claim that there is no way to rectify them short of a complete transformation of the dominant way of life. He wants to change the way people are behaving, and this huge endeavor is his way of trying to make people see the light. The negative misanthropic outlook is based on different types of human flaws, moral flaws, unethical decisions, and these are often seen as the foundational factor. They include cruelty, selfishness, injustice, greed, and indifference to the suffering of others. So that's similar to the 7 deadly sins. And then this can result in harm to humans with genocides or to animals with factory farming of livestock. So his misanthropic point of view, being a misanthrope, no connection to humanity, no connection to society. He sees nothing he likes. All he sees is the bad in people, and he wants to punish people for that. So John, more than anything, is a misanthrope.
That's a great explanation.
Thank you.
And vocab word of the day.
Misanthrope.
Misanthrope. Or is it misanthrope?
Dude, I don't fucking know.
I think it's misanthrope. Or maybe it probably is misanthrope. It depends on what country you're in, I think, whether you're UK or
there's a 50-50 shot I say a word correctly, so.
50-50 shot. It's the best odds I've had in years.
And I mean, it ties to reference to Interstellar. Ties this idea. I mean, I want to ask you. So obviously religion plays a huge factor into John in his life and his entire approach to what he's doing. Do you think that he's using religion as an excuse or in using religion as a justification for what he's doing? Or do you really think, this is kind of a fun way to look at the film, do you really think that he was called by a higher being like God?
It's something I debate with myself every time I see this film, because it's so interesting, because of course you look at the surface and John Doe is a crazy person. He's a misanthrope, like Anthony said. And is he just somebody who's using religion as a way to justify his actions? He wanted to take pleasure in killing people, as he wanted to punish people for their sins in a very, very extreme way. An old school New Testament horrific violence times 1,000 way.
Gonna get Old Testament on his ass.
Has he been, is he using religion and its text in obviously using the words from the Bible and twisting it into his own way to justify what he's doing. Because on the surface, you can say that it's happening. And of course, before the final murder, one of the most interesting conversations that happens is between Somerset and Doe and Mills. And
glad you asked.
Glad you asked. And John Doe's in the back, and they're just both curious. They're asking questions. Mostly, Somerset's asking a few questions here and there, articulately, whereas Mills is trying to rile him up, and he's antagonizing him. And Somerset asks a great question and kind of calls John Doe out, where he says, there's a glaring contradiction in what you do and what you say. You say you were chosen by God. You say you're walking a higher path, that this was the work of a higher power. But why do you take so much pleasure in it? Why do you take so much enjoyment in killing, in butchering, in torturing, in murdering? And John Doe, for a second, seems, oh, that's a good question. I think he got it.
Perturbed.
Gotcha.
You can see Spacey, he's like, his eyes are going back and forth. He's like trying to come up with an answer.
And he has a pretty good answer. He says, there's nothing wrong with a man taking pleasure in his work. Similar to Mills, if he wanted to take pleasure in me being in a room with me by myself with the doors off, with the windows closed, you know, with impunity.
I'm sure it wouldn't be much different from Mills getting time alone with me in a room with no windows.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The only thing that's stopping you is punishment.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's stopping you. You can see in Mills' eyes that he's absolutely correct. And so that begs the question, you know, it's a good answer. It's a solid answer, I think, from John Doe's perspective. And I think Somerset agrees to an extent. But still, you know, this could all just be for show in terms of, I wanted an excuse to do this because I'm such an evil guy and I've had to lash out and I hate people and I'm using religion to motivate myself and to justify my actions. But what happens? He fulfills his mission. He finishes it. He sacrifices himself by turning Mills into wrath after John Doe's sin of envy is being envious of Mills' normal life, killing his wife Tracy, causing Mills to become wrath, to kill John Doe, which means he's done what he's set out to do. All this work, all this planning, all this detail, all this meticulous time has been a success. And John Doe has won. He has won the game. He is the winner of this movie. He is the winner of Seven.
Mills is the loser.
John Doe wins. And it's really fascinating to think that, even though he says what I have done, what I will have accomplished will be studied forever. You know, I will go down in history, basically. People will puzzle over it. And if that happened in real life today, if someone did these murders, hopefully not, thank God, I hope to God not. But if someone did murders like this, like the seven deadly sins, it would be studied forever. It absolutely would be. There'd be 20 Netflix movies and a docuseries and a TV series and a Hulu original, and it'd be insane. There'd be an origin story of John Doe. And what was John Doe before he was John Doe? Before it'd be insane because people would be obsessed with it, and it would be studied. So, because he completes his task and his mission, does that make him – does it prove that he had divine intervention, that he was chosen? It's possible. If he didn't succeed – in his mission, then no. But because he did, that's what makes it such a fun debate.
He's more than a T-shirt.
He is.
And also, to get behind what John Doe's line was of enjoying his work, nothing wrong with someone enjoying their work. If a higher power was to choose someone to commit these kinds of acts and do this kind of horrible endeavor, it would have to be someone who would enjoy it, because someone who didn't enjoy it wouldn't be able to carry them out. You know what I mean? So in a way, he's like the perfect dark choice, the dark human for this task. Perfect soldier for this kind of endeavor. So you could play around with that idea, and it is interesting. Now, I'm glad you pointed out that he won and that he succeeded.
Glad you asked.
And what's that? So John Doe does win. He does succeed. And he had complete faith that all of his tests would work. It was really easy for him to lose. Everything could have gone wrong. His first test could have gone wrong. You know what I mean?
They were knocking on his door,
yeah. So, it's interesting that he had complete faith that all of it would work, that all of the victims would pass his test of carrying out the acts he instructed them to do. Now, obviously, he had to get a little physical with some of them and hold guns to their heads, but they did it all. So the first way it could have gone wrong is the glutton could have just refused to eat. The glutton maybe could have had a little more bravery and courage than John Doe expected and refused to eat enough food to kill himself. Secondly, Eli Gould could have succeeded in cutting off his own flesh. It's very likely maybe he didn't choose that spot, or maybe he was a little more wise about the anatomy of himself and chose a different part of his body. He could have passed that test. It's possible. It's very possible. Also, the man in the brothel could have said no while he was wearing the knife object thing. Even though John Doe put a gun in his mouth, and John Doe did have to go that far to get the man to do it, obviously, he could have eventually ended up refusing John Doe. And then the bride victim could have called for help. It's possible. She could have called the phone, called 911, and lived with herself being disfigured on her face. She could have succeeded that test. And Mills could have spared John at the end. It's possible. It's up in the air. Mills almost didn't kill him. It really took Mills some time to just make the decision to shoot him in the face. And really it was, I think, John egging him on too. And there's that memory and the image of Tracy he thinks of in his mind. But Mills could have spared John Doe. So all these things could have gone wrong. However, it all worked out. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, not to mention, Tracy and Mills weren't part of his original plan.
Exactly.
This is a plan that John Doe has been working on for years in meticulous details. He could have found someone else for the brothel, probably. You know, he had just obviously picked a specific sex worker to target. He could have targeted another sex worker.
His target was the worker, not the guy.
Not the guy. But Detective Mills and his wife Tracy were not part of this plan, clearly. And you have to guess that it was a pivot that John Doe did, because Mills and Somerset found his apartment, probably. You know, that wasn't part of the plan. He wasn't expecting detectives to be knocking on his door to have to probably have another apartment somewhere else. I'm sure he does, to continue his plan elsewhere and give up all of his belongings to the police and all of the evidence already and everything they need to keep going on the case, even though they weren't going to find him eventually.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't plan on that happening to his apartment. He didn't plan on Mills and Somerset being there. But I think because he was so maybe impressed with Somerset and Mills, and also he made it personal by including Mills and Somerset in this.
And Mills just got hired. He had no...
Exactly.
There's no way he could have known he would have been given this case.
His first day on the job was Monday. Yeah. That was his first day on the job. It's not like he was there for months.
Yeah.
So it's so fascinating that he changed the plan. Not only did he have to change the plan because they found him at his apartment, but then he changed the plan where Wrath and Envy were altered. I'm sure he had targets in mind.
Definitely, yeah.
But now it's been changed to, I'm going to do it with Mills because I admire him. I admire Mills, and I want him to be a part of this. And obviously, I think he probably saw something in Mills that he could target that rage, that frustration, the emotions. It's incredible seeing a man feeding off his emotions. You know, when he goes to take photographs in the stairwell, he sees that Mills is a hothead. But what does Mills do? He loves his wife so, so much. And you can assume he's spying on them, probably. He's probably spying on Mills. He's close by, I'm sure.
Well, do you know, have you seen the theories online?
Which theories?
So there's two scenes where it looks like John Doe is wandering through the background of the scene. So there's the diner scene where they have with Somerset and Mills. Oh, no, it's Somerset and Tracy. And then
she tells him she's pregnant.
In the background, you can see a man who looks quite like Kevin Spacey walking past. And he stops and looks at them for a moment and then continues on. So in the diner scene.
I got to watch that scene again.
And then in that sex shop manufacturer scene.
The leather store.
Yeah, the leather store. Thank you. The leather store. As Mills and Somerset are questioning the clerk, in the background, outside the window, you can see someone looking in who looks kind of like Kevin Spacey wearing a hat. It could be nothing, or they could be little hints that David Fincher put in the film saying that John Doe is keeping track of whoever's investigating the case and watching them while they're looking into clues.
He should. If I was
It would make sense, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're self-employed. or I mean, not self-employed. He's independently wealthy, mm-hmm. obviously educated. This is his purpose, his mission in life. He's got multiple apartments, probably got a couple safe houses. He has enough money to do whatever he wants. And this is part of his of protecting his mission, you could say, is knowing what the detectives are thinking, what the police are thinking. So that's really interesting. I'm going to have to go back and watch those scenes over again because I am fascinated by that.
People did zoom-ins and stuff. It kind of looks like Spacey's face. I'm not going to lie.
I love when directors do stuff like that.
It looks, and it would make sense. John Doe is so intelligent that he's obviously keeping track of who's investigating him.
What I really find fascinating about this movie is when we first get to see inside John Doe's apartment, because it is disturbing as hell, but it's exactly what you expect. And I think they did a really great job with the production design in this movie. You know,
yeah, the set design is amazing.
Really disturbing imagery. We have that neon red cross over his bed. We have dozens of empty bottles of aspirin inside his drawer, his bedside drawer, because he gets such bad headaches. And he talks about it inside his diaries, his journals.
I think that's a reference to Zodiac.
Possibly. We have framed... Well, this movie came out before Zodiac.
The Zodiac Killer.
The Zodiac
Not
Killer.
The movie.
With aspirin?
Yeah, he always had headaches.
Oh, that's right. It's a good point. That's a good point, Anthony. He has those framed window trophies of his murders. So we have, for example, we have a can of spaghetti with blood on it. We have the hand of Vincent. We have the bloody books from the lawyer. So he's got some of the trophies from his murders. We have the receipt from the leather shop, which leads them to that shop eventually. A photo red room inside of his bathroom, which he obviously develops his portraits and photos of. He has a library. And inside this library, lots of books, but many of them are his handwritten journals that have no dates, no order, no alphabetization, no chronology. It's just random thoughts. His mind poured out into paper. And not to mention, there isn't a single fingerprint in the entire apartment because we learn eventually he cuts off the tips of his fingers. He's been doing it for a while. And 2,000 notebooks, each with 250 pages, single space, double side pages. His mind poured out onto paper and a phone hidden somewhere.
Yeah. Plus the black walls.
Black walls, exactly.
The black walls are really messed up. Like they're super creepy. In terms of the journals, so the production team really didn't make all those journals. It was two members of the production design team. They spent $15,000 on the journals. And it's not just for all the journals. They put a lot of stuff in, like arts and crafts in the journals. You know, there's a lot of stuff we see in the opening are things they put in the journals. So all these photos and interesting things, they would sew them and stuff. Now, there's a little confusion. They didn't write 2,000 pages worth of diary. It's not like they were like, oh, here's the real. It's not like some mad diary. They actually wrote the same page, the same text on every page. You can actually see zoom-ins people have done on freeze frames, and every page of every notebook has the same text on it.
Mm-hmm.
So that they didn't like come up with this giant Bible of John Doe's thoughts. That would be impossible, and like you'd have to be messed up to really dive in like that. So they did just make one basically narrative and then rewrote that over and over and over again,
mm-hmm.
which is super cool. And it just looks amazing. And that moment when they bust through that door, it's like, holy shit, what's behind that door? And it lived up to that hype.
I'd like to go back and talk about John Doe and whether or not he's chosen by a higher power, because he's obviously enticed by the idea of immortality in the real world after death. He wants to be remembered. He wants to be studied. He wants to be put on a pedestal. You know, that's what he wants, and it's what he'll get eventually because he succeeds. But also, if he's religious and he does believe in God, he believes in heaven and hell, he's sending himself to hell for eternal damnation. Forever he will be in hell if that's what he believes. So can you argue that he doesn't quite believe? Do you think that means that he's just using religion as a justification? Because who would want to damn themselves to hell for eternity? Or maybe he thinks that he'll be forgiven for what he's done because he's opened people's eyes to their sins, because sinning makes him sick, yet he commits some of the most heinous sins you could ever do.
I think that John is actually a committer of three sins, which explain this. And one of the sins, So he's not just guilty of envy. He's personally guilty of pride. And he's also guilty of wrath. So the thing is, his biggest sin is pride, because he believes he's more than just a man who had this higher, and he had this higher calling. I know he says that I'm nobody, but he really does think he's better. And I think that his pride has blinded him into thinking that he's doing something in service of God. And so I think that he doesn't believe that he would be punished for what he's doing. So his pride is, you know, he thinks that he knows the world better than anyone else. And he thinks that he's like the only person alive who really sees the truth. That's pride talking. Also, he doesn't feel the need to carry out, he also feels this need to carry out a lesson for humanity. He wants to teach humanity a lesson. Like, he thinks he knows better than everyone. He's also, his pride shows up when he says he clearly is looking forward to being studied. He's clearly looking forward to being a legend, a myth. He wants to be puzzled over. He's really looking forward to that. And you can see that Spacey does this, like, these very subtle, like, positive, like, kind of smiles. And when he's just thinking about it, and his tone is just, like, his inflection, he's just, it's something that gives him pleasure. The idea of being remembered forever, you know, that's also a sign of pride. He's proud of what he's doing. He's proud of the work he's doing. And this pride blinds him from recognizing that he's guilty of other sins. And I think that pride shows that he doesn't think any of these sins will cause punishment for him. And so his other major sin is obviously wrath. He tortures and kills innocent people out of hatred and out of apathy. And so wrath is his other sin. So it's not just envy. He was already guilty of wrath before the investigation even began. And so he's guilty of three of the major deadly sins. However, his pride blinds him from seeing any of it, and his pride absolves himself from responsibility.
Interesting. Interesting. How about we take a break, because we've been talking about murder for so long. We'll run to our intermission, but then we'll be back to discuss more of John Doe and Seven. But before we continue, the best way to support Raiders of the Lost Podcast is to become a patron at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Why would you want to do this? Because you get access to the ad-free version of every single episode, plus bonus episodes every single week, and access to our Discord, personal video messages, watch party access, so many great perks, free merchandise. There's so many goddamn things. So many things. Just please sign up for Patreon.
Please sign up. I need Trader Joe's.
It's the only way we can do the show full time. We're so grateful for all of our incredible patrons in the film community that's grown from it and blossomed. Thank you all so, so much. We appreciate you. To the moon and back. Another great way to support the show is to leave those 5-star ratings and reviews on Spotify and Apple. Why would you want to do this? Because it helps us get seen by new viewers. It builds up that rep, you know, 2,000 ratings on 2,300 on Spotify. It's pretty badass.
It's a shit ton.
But we really want to hit 5,000 on Apple, because when we do, I'm getting a tattoo of Anthony's choice.
Oh, yeah.
So leave those Apple reviews. I'll read one out in just a minute. I can't talk right now. Another great way to support the show is to just share us. Word of mouth is the best way for a podcast to grow organically. Let everyone you know who loves cinema, who loves movies, who loves Seven, about this podcast, Raiders of Lost Podcast.
Which is sponsored by our friends at movieposters.com, the number one place to get your posters online today. Be sure to use our promo code Raiders10 at movieposters.com to get 10% off your order right now. They have a huge selection of pretty much every movie and TV show imaginable in their poster library. If you want a poster of Seven, go on over to movieposters.com. They have all sorts of sizes, framing, and even backlighting for your poster needs. These prints look incredible. They're very well priced, and they have everything a movie lover could desire, and a ton of TV posters. So for all of your poster needs, if you need one to deck your place out, if you need to get a present for the movie lover in your life, go to movieposters.com and use our promo code Raiders10 right now to get 10% off your order.
Today.
Now,
let's get into our movie intermission and start the movie quote competition. Are you ready?
Ready.
I've always liked you, Byron, but you never know when to shut up. Even bad men love their mamas.
Huh. Can you say it again, please?
I've always liked you, Byron, but you never know when to shut up. Even bad men love their mamas.
310 Yuma.
Yes, sir.
Russell Crowe.
Yep.
Nice.
Ben Wade.
All right, here's mine. I don't want to kill anybody, but if I got to get out that door and you're standing in my way, one way or the other, you're getting out of my way.
It's like a reinterpretation of Heat. Brother, you're going down.
You're going down. Yep. There's a flip side to that coin.
Can you say that one more time?
I don't want to kill anybody, but if I got to get out that door and you're standing in my way, one way or the other, you're getting out of my way.
I don't know.
Reservoir Dogs, Mr. Pink.
Oh, my gosh. That's good.
Not bad.
Guess gotcha. This movie release here. 8 Mile.
Dun, 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 dun.
Mom, spaghetti.
Dun, 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 dun. 2002. Damn, that's old. Fucking old. You know Mackie's the guy who got who lost the rap battle
theater? Clarence.
Yeah, Clarence.
Clarence's parents had a real nice marriage.
Because he grew up like in the suburbs.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. What year did Reservoir Dogs come out?
Reservoir Dogs. Why am I blanking on this? Is it because Fiction's obviously 94. Reservoir Dogs is. It's either 91 or 92. It's 19. Fuck. Is it 91 or 92? 91 or 92. Should I flip a coin?
You should make a decision.
91.
92. Okay, 0 for 2 on wow. Reservoir Dogs.
That's wow. I can't believe I got that one wrong, too.
Well, there's a third one, so I hope you get that one.
Wow, I'm just, like, embarrassed right now. I don't know why I said 91.
You should hang up the gloves.
I don't know why I said 91. I'm such an idiot. All right, Anthony. What movie has both Chris Hemsworth and Sigourney Weaver in it?
Cabin in the Woods, baby.
Yes, sir.
Cabin in the Woods.
Nice job.
Good question. It made me think for a second.
Yeah.
It almost got me. I was like, what? All right, here's my quiz question. It's another Tarantino question. You better get it right. Harvey Keitel and Quentin Tarantino shared the screen in what 3 films?
Harvey Keitel and Quentin Tarantino shared the screen in what 3 films? Was that the question?
That's the question. Did I stutter? It sounded clear to me. Sounds like you're stalling.
No, I know it. It's From Dusk Till Dawn, Reservoir Dogs, and Pulp Fiction.
Well done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Amazing.
I had to get one of those right. I can't believe I fucked up the year, man.
Boys question. What's Harvey Keitel's role in Inglourious Basterds?
He's the operator he's on the other line of the phone.
He's a general.
Yeah, he's the general.
Not the operator, but yeah.
I mean, the radio.
You're right. Yeah, you're right.
When they're getting the...
Well done, sir.
The terms of my surrender. Terms of my... What does he call it? Something surrender.
Yeah, something, yeah. He had a good phrase for it.
Yeah, it was a good turn of phrase.
Lots of good phrases. Nice job, though. Nice job. We got some haters this week.
Let's hear them, man. I would love to hear these.
Trent wrote... Just listen to your Daniel Craig episode. You said that Chris Cornell's first band was Stone Temple Pilots, but it was actually Soundgarden. Unsubscribed.
Thank you for the correction. We often speak out of our butts.
Next up, Giant Believer wrote, I thought it was pronounced Incendee. Unsubscribed. But at least you both have Dune 2 in your top 3. Resubscribed.
Incendees.
Sneaky XD wrote, you misspelled the. You just put the. How do you misspell the unsubscribed the title?
In what episode?
Denis Villeneuve. I caught it in the morning.
Oh, my God.
I caught it in the morning. All right. Next up, Burpee. Neither of you have seen City Slickers? Unsubscribed. We have not.
That was the Jake Gyllenhaal's first movie.
Yeah. All right. Cole Delworth wrote, Anthony doesn't like boobs? Unsubscribed. For the record, I love boobs. Fake news.
Toxic man over there. How dare you say you love boobs?
Everyone likes boobs.
It's true. Boobs are great.
All right, next up, Mason wrote, you guys are assuming I haven't seen any of these on the best horror movies you've never seen. Unsubscribe.
That's a funny comment.
And then Jeremy Walker, the Timmy Chlamydia story was a fanfic. Don't slander my boy. Unsubscribed. We went on for 5 minutes about Timothy Chalamet and Chlamydia. Oh, man. Next up, the Guidi wrote, comparing Tremors to the dumpster fire that is Dune? Unsubscribed. I stand corrected. Well done, everyone. Those are funny.
Those are great.
Those are good ones.
We have a great 5-star written review on Apple. I would love to read out. From Dylan Curtis.
What's up, Dylan?
Best movie podcast. 5 stars. I've been listening to this gruesome doosome for well over 3 years now, and I always find myself coming back weekly to this epic channel, whether it's covering beloved film, breaking down movie news, or rating listeners' Letterboxd top 4. These hilarious twins provide hours of tight-knit movie content with a side of silly, irrational banter. P.S. I think James may have skipped over my Letterboxd top 4 that I sent in last fall. Unsubscribe!
James, you did it.
Anthony handles the letter.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Hey, Dylan, just so you know, Anthony handles that.
Dylan.
Anthony handles it all.
I'm sorry, Dylan.
So resend it because Anthony messed it up. Seriously, though, these two good-hearted gentlemen are a gift to the film community. Film boy for life!
Film boy!
P.S.S. I bought an iPad just to write this review. Aww, wow. Shucks. Thanks, pal.
Wow. I mean, you could have just done an email, but yeah. iPad.
Can you download Apple with a
with an Android? Actually, I don't think so.
I think you can get it on a computer, though.
You need iOS software.
You
need iOS software, I think.
Well, Dylan, if that's the case.
Dylan!
Thank you, pal.
Dylan!
We appreciate it. For anyone who doesn't have an iPhone, I guess maybe if you just go to the Apple store, you can do it.
go to the Apple store and leave us a review.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Dylan's
the best. That's a great review. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, pal.
What's your streaming recommendation, Anthony?
My streaming recommendation this week is Total Recall. It was actually put on Prime today, so go watch that ASAP.
Mine, I'd pick something very light. Something.
Oh, sorry. Was Dylan, how you spell Dylan?
Dylan Curtis, D-I-L-L-O-N.
Oh, I thought we did him last week. If not, I'll have to get him in there. Oh, we did him. We did him last week. Yeah.
Dylan, we got you last week.
We got you. It just didn't catch up. Sometimes Apple reviews are late, so he did that a while ago, the review copy. But we got him in there.
All right. Tune in last Letterbox, pal. What was yours, Stream Rec?
Total Recall.
Okay. My streaming recommendation, something light, because of this heavy subject matter, something from our childhood. It's on Netflix now. Land Before Time.
Aw. Wow, that's a good one. I mean, that's not that light. It's a tragedy, too.
It's still like a...
Yeah, we're going to cry for half of it.
Yeah, but it's still a kid's movie. It's about dinosaurs that talk.
True. It is pretty light.
It's fucking great, man.
Yeah, okay.
It's pretty light.
I mean, it's scary and there's lots of tears.
You know what?
It's not that light.
At least it's not serial killing.
Total Recall is lighter than Land Before Time.
You know what's about to happen? A crime of passion is about to happen inside this fucking studio, Anthony. I'm going to murder you.
So your deadly sin is wrath.
Look at all that passion on the wall.
James is wrath.
Let's get back into our episode of 7. We both just quoted it, basically. Now, what else would you like to talk about with John Doe?
I have a couple of things I'd like to talk about.
Well, actually, I don't want to talk about those.
Well, we're too late.
We're doing it.
I actually did a psychological breakdown of John Doe.
What makes you qualified to do this?
Absolutely nothing. So, if case you don't know, there is a comic book series of 7 that the studio produced.
After the film.
Not by the same writer. So, it's technically not canon, but there's a comic book, 7 issues, graphic novels about each sin and the backstory for each one, as well as John Doe's backstory.
Also, it's sort of a prequel.
Yes. They created a backstory, but I didn't like it. I disagree with it.
What was it? He worked at Target and was just depressed?
Apparently, he had a wife who, like, left him and stuff. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense for John Doe to have a wife.
Sounds like the Joker.
Yeah. I read the
comic book Joker. Yeah,
I read a summary of it. I was like, that's honestly ass. I wrote my own backstory.
You wrote your own backstory of John Doe?
I was upbringing. Just a quick synopsis of what I think would inform what he became as an adult.
Let's hear it.
Now, first up, I want to tell you what I think he did for a profession before the events of the film. So I believe that John Doe was a member of the press, which is mentioned in the film, in which he poses as multiple times. He poses really when he takes a photo of them, then he poses off screen when he collects information about Mills. So as a member of the press, this gave John access to the darkest aspects of humanity. His profession tasked him with reporting and examining crimes within the city. This constant exposure to the horrors of the world is what helped turn him so sour towards humanity, seeing just the bleakness, having to report on crimes and murders, having to report on rapes, having to write stories about all this. This is also how he knows that press can get information from within the police system. This is how he gets information about Mills and where he lives and stuff like that. So it makes sense. He's also a photographer. He has his own light studio in his apartment.
Plus, he knows how to not leave evidence, probably from reading files and exactly. cases and studying.
He's an expert criminal. An expert. The only evidence that's left is the evidence that he purposely leaves them. And so, there's actually a behind-the-scenes interview of the set photographer. This guy, I can't remember, John Moore or something? John Allen or something. He was one of the great set photo takers of movies. Like, he's taken photos on films for decades. He was the set photographer for Seven, so he was there on most days of set taking the photos behind the scenes. And there's an interview with him, and they're inside John Doe's apartment, and nearby where he's sitting, there's a press badge with John Doe's photo on it, and it says Ray Moore on it. This is not in the film. It's in a behind-the-scenes interview with the set photographer. And so this could be evidence that his name really is Ray Moore, and John Doe was a member of the press and a crime journalist and photographer for years in the city. What do you think about that?
I like that theory a lot.
Yeah.
It seems to fit. It fits really well. But also, yeah, journalists can work for sure. It's possible for sure. Yeah, I like that a lot. I also, if we're just kind of making our own assumptions or maybe a medical professional, possibly. Because of the things he does to people, the ways he knows how to kill, or the ways he knows how to keep someone alive. But he's just obviously very well educated, so he can mm-hmm. learn those things with a library card. But he's someone who has a lot of time on his hands and is independently wealthy. So is he independently wealthy from work, or is he independently wealthy from family, inheritance, something like that? So he could still be pressed and independently wealthy at the same time.
Yeah, he could have had a good inheritance, or he could have just – he's just extremely frugal.
Yeah.
He could see – he strikes me as someone who has like – rice and something for every meal.
Yeah, it's something very simple. But also, you know, press, it could be an identity of who he was, or maybe it's just a fake identity he's created to become press, to gain access to crime scenes, gain access to circles and private things and exclusive situations. So that's possible, but I think mm-hmm. that's a really interesting theory.
It fits.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it does fit.
It does fit.
All right, let's get to his upbringing and what I think John Doe's upbringing was like. And this is just based upon the film and what I think would create a monster like this. So John Doe must have had an extremely religious childhood in which the importance of rejecting sin was constantly hammered into his mind in an extreme way. He was probably raised in a very small and isolated community, and his father was most likely physically abusive, and his mother could have been emotionally abusive. He was definitely punished as a child very often for the slightest sins, like being locked in a room or being hit or spanked or whipped, maybe even more extreme circumstances of punishments. And it's likely that the punishments would get extreme and physical, thus making him repulsed by sinners. And in adulthood, fueling his desire to punish sinners himself. He was never shown love or tenderness by his parents, and he has never had an intimate relationship with another human being, and most likely is still a virgin. As an adult, he moved to the big city, where he was overwhelmed with the stimulation, the number of people, and the grim realities of society, plus the dark aspects of human nature, which he saw in his profession as a crime photojournalist. This was too much for him to bear. He saw sinners everywhere. He thought, how could the world be like this? And so he took up the pain of his childhood and inflicted it upon the sinners of the world.
Interesting theory. I like the strong religious background mm-hmm. from family. That makes sense. That doesn't make a lot of sense because, you know, not a lot of people go to religions themselves. They're born into a religion, and some people enforce it intensely on their children. Some mm-hmm. people don't. So I think that makes a lot of sense.
And also, I read Andrew Kevin Walker, one of the main inspirations for the screenplay was he moved from a small town into the city, and he was like, the culture shock was really big, riveting for him, and so he infused that into the story. And so I put that into the background of being from a very small, isolated, close-knit community and then moving into the big city and being overwhelmed by it.
Interesting stuff. I like that a lot. Thanks. Anything else in your psychological background?
That's it for my breakdown for his background.
You know, there's two moments in this film that I think are really terrific for John Doe that are really interesting with his plan. And the first one is obviously we were talking about how he changes his plans and improvises. He sort of improvises on the spot in terms of changing everything around. And obviously, we were talking about how he has a target for Wrath. He has a target for Envy, which he probably has been working on. But then he switches it to Mills to be the target for Wrath and Envy, with Mills being Wrath and John being Envy, envious of his normal life and his wife, Tracy. And this happens sort of on a whim, because when Somerset and Mills show up to the apartments, John Doe is shooting to kill.
Mm-hmm.
He's not shooting to scare. He's not shooting to injure. He's shooting to kill. And he gets away. It's one of the best foot chases I've ever seen in a movie.
Oh,
too,
so good.
By the way. But he's shooting to kill until they get to the alley. He's on top of the truck, and Mills doesn't see him. He gets hit in the head, in the hand, breaks his arm. And John Doe jumps down from the truck. It's raining, obviously. And what's he do? He puts the gun to Mills' temple. And just before he pulls the trigger, he hesitates, he stops, and obviously he hears Somerset in the distance. But he doesn't kill Mills when he was trying to kill Mills just a minute before. You could argue at that moment, that's the moment that I think I'm going to put this guy in the mix now. I think I'm going to make this personal.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to just improvise on the spot like that.
Yeah, I think it's when he's holding the gun against Mills' temple.
He's about to shoot him, then he's like, never mind.
I can play with this guy.
I'm gonna use him.
What a great shot, too.
Yeah.
That shot with it's the close-up with the pistol on the left side of the frame, and then John Doe is out of focus alongside the left side of the frame. It's just fantastic. And when I watched this movie last night, it really did feel like a classic noir film.
Yeah.
From the 40s.
Don't get movies like this anymore.
Yeah, it felt like a movie Orson Welles made because of shots like that, and also seeing the reflection of John Doe in the puddle. This, and also the lighting techniques and shooting from overhead with this crazy contrasting lighting. I would really love to watch this movie in black and white.
That's a good.
I think I might edit it in black and white and just watch it.
That'd be cool.
Just for myself.
Wow. Another shot that I really love of John Doe is when he's in the back of the car with Somerset and Mills on their way to what he has told investigators and the police will be two bodies that he's made the deal, the plea bargain, that he'll plead guilty if Mills and Somerset take him to these bodies and he'll show where the bodies are, right? If not, he'll plead insanity.
Yeah.
And they have until 6 o'clock. So they're on their way and they're getting pretty close and they're going back and forth in their discourse between Somerset, Mills, and John Doe until there's some silence. But then in the back seat, John Doe just starts kind of dancing. He's like kind of bouncing. He's giddy. And then Somerset asks why he's so excited, and he says, It's close. It's just disturbing to see. He's just dancing in the back of the seat because he knows what's about to happen.
Spacey's performance is really fascinating, and it's why this character is so powerful. And he obviously, as we all know from just one watch, he portrays John Doe with a complete absence of emotion and disconnect. And there's like this really eerie, calm, and soothing demeanor that John Doe has within most situations. And it's almost like he's kind of bored half the time. He has this like look on his face. He has this incredibly monotonous tone. He's very slow in his movements, and he's very controlled. I mean, just the way he dips the teabag in, and the way he's talking to his lawyer, it looks like he's just like randomly looking through paperwork, and it doesn't look like he's worried at all. Obviously, he has a big plan. But he does show emotion, and he does become untethered, and it happens in the taxi cab. I mean, in the cruiser, and it's when Mills is antagonizing him and Somerset is pushing him, and he starts describing when Mills says you'd kill innocent people, And that really triggers John. That's when he goes on his big monologue. Only a city like this can you, only in a city that shitty as this,
fucked up, yeah.
Can you call these people innocent? And he just goes off on every one of his victims with
innocent.
Yeah. Animosity, with rage. He's screaming. He's lost complete control of his emotions. And he goes on this tangent, which you'd never seen before because he was so controlled and so calm in every other situation. And so it's really interesting, and it showcases the rage and the hatred he has for humanity in that moment, because that's what set him off, the idea that these people were innocent. And that's what put John over the edge. He was calm and controlled and collected talking to the detectives in the car. But then once Mills brought up that the people were innocent, he freaked out. And that's so telling for his character.
Yeah, I wonder if he realizes that he's done terrible things because his murders are forced attrition. If he's religious, that's what they would be. There's sins that he's forcing himself to do, and he's forcing himself upon this attrition.
Yeah. And what's so brilliant about John, what's so brilliant about John in the film is that he is helping the cops the whole time. Throughout the entire course of the film, he's leaving breadcrumbs and he's leaving evidence. And still, they were completely hopeless until they got the help from the FBI Stinky Man. And so the ways he helps the police is he calls it, I think he's the one who called him the Gluttony Man and not like neighbors who smelled something. I think it was like, so I think that he wanted, because it had to be timed perfectly for them to show up on that Monday. So I think that he called in the Gluttony Man. He obviously fed plastic from the floor to the Gluttony Man. This was a clue for Mills in Somerset, for Somerset to find and then connect it to the floor and move the fridge. He obviously paints around Mrs. Gold's eyes, hangs the painting upside down, leaves the fingerprints leading them to Vincent. He spares Mills, like you just mentioned, in the alleyway. He calls the police, and then he walks into the precinct. And so the thing is, his plans and his crimes are so perfect that he had to leave clues, because otherwise the police would never have found him at all. They would have never found anything. His crimes were so precise that he had to help them to get to the next step.
What were you doing? Biding your time.
Biding your time. I seem to remember knocking on your door.
It's good stuff. All right, you got anything else?
I like a bunch of his quotes. Wanting people to listen, you can't just tap them on the shoulder anymore. You have to hit them in the head with a sledgehammer. And then you'll notice you've got their strict attention.
It's a good line.
It's my favorite line from the film.
And why, you relate to it?
No, I think it's just a great line. And ultimately, I think Seven is a depiction of evil and violence. And it's great seeing movies with huge villains like Lord of the Rings and Star Wars. I love all that shit. But oftentimes, I think that when the evil is just a person, for me, that's more terrifying.
I agree.
They're just a man.
That's why he's one of the all-time antagonists in cinema history.
Yeah.
Well, that wraps our episode on John Doe and this episode of Evil Explored on Raiders of Lost Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning into this show. Become a patron today at patreon.com/Raiders of the Lost Podcast. Leave those 5-star ratings and reviews and share us with your family and friends. Take care, everybody.
See you next time.